Welcome back to the Untangling Web3 podcast. Now, since 2020, DeFi has become the biggest application of Web3, accounting for more than 34% of all daily activity and with more than $100 billion in value. But today, it's still a preserve of crypto natives. How do we onboard the rest of the world to DeFi? To help us answer that question, we're joined by Dan Hughes, a seasoned technologist, game developer, and now founder of Radix DLT. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Great to be here.
Excited to have you on. Excited to hear a fellow British accent. Assumed you're American. Whenever we get a big person in the crypto space on, they're always American. So this is exciting for me and Jack to have you on the show. Yeah, and today we're going to be talking, not many Brits in the space, so it's refreshing. Today we're going to be talking about your company, what you're doing. But before we get into all that, we kind of want to take it nice and slow and explain, what is DeFi? You know, it seemed like everyone was talking about fintech 10 years ago, and now the word that's being used everywhere is DeFi. So in your mind, though, what does DeFi mean?
It's decentralized finance, right? So that basically means there's no kind of bank that's responsible for, you know, being a middleman or an intermediary to things that you're doing. So you're very much interacting on these financial instruments and products yourself, which means, you know, there's certain things that you can do and certain financial products that aren't possible in the regular sense. More innovative products, because the possibilities are, you know, the potential is much different. But there's also some downsides as well, of course, right? Like, there is, if it goes wrong, there's nobody's door to really go and bang on. If you're new to all this stuff, then it's very exciting and lots of opportunities, but just take care and go slow, and read lots of informative blogs and get educated before you start to do anything major. But, you know,
well, as you know, like, most people don't have time to read anything. So, like, if you were to say to them, okay, why should they care about DeFi? You know, I have been using my bank for the last 20 years. I know the Santander, the HSBC, this DeFi where take that person out or take that entity out in the middle. Why is that beneficial? What's the kind of the use case that it should interest me because of that?
So there's a lot more opportunity, and there's more innovation, right? So, like, the kinds of products, probably the most the biggest one over the past few years is definitely something like Uniswap, right? With swap pools and stuff. Like, those kind of products just didn't exist anywhere before and probably couldn't have anyway. And so they're a really nice, simple to use way of swapping from one asset kind to another, with no intermediary, no middleman, and you're kind of, you're in control of that as well, right? And the results are immediate. You can see them in your wallet. And it also kind of falls into this whole principle of self-sovereignty, right? Where you are in control of your finances. You're in charge of, you know, it's on your wallet, right? There isn't a bank who, if the bank fails, it's gone, right? Like, that's one of the pros, of course. But then the con is that you've got to make sure that you have the right level of education and security to manage those assets properly. But if you see an opportunity somewhere in the crypto market, you can also react very fast to it, right? So just go slow, but enjoy and
not financial advice.
No financial advice. Just start small, be careful. Like, you know, there's a lot to learn, and it can be quite complicated. So people don't like to read, right? They just want results now. But I would hope that when there's your money involved, you would maybe at least read one page of something.
Yeah, that's true. I think, like, the kind of the analogy that most people use, if we're trying to put it into, say, every man speak, would be around cash versus money. It's like, when you're talking about self-sovereignty, that's like quite a big, ambiguous, scary term.
Owning cash,
right?
Yeah, it's much broader than that, really, right? It's like, you can also extend it to, like, data, right? Like, I own my data, yeah? Where, you know, if there was an app, like, Facebook farms people's data and social media networks and stuff, right? And then they sell that information on to advertising agencies and stuff like that, and you have no say, right? So, but your self-sovereignty of your data means that you have a say in what happens to that data, right? In the same way that you have a say in what happens to your money, right? Like, if you have it in the bank may have some investment strategy, you know, to make profits for the shareholders at the end of the year. And if you don't agree with it, it's tough, right? The only thing you can do is take your money out and go to another bank, and you know, you kind of vote with your feet, as it were. Yeah. But in terms of self-sovereign money, you're in charge of it, right? The responsibility is wholly yours. And if there's something that you don't like, then you just don't use that particular product.
Like, we are in the, you know, high-minded selected few who think sovereignty is the most important thing. When you go talk to someone on the street and you say, you don't own your data, they'll be like, what do you mean I don't own my data? Okay, do you want to own your data? Don't care. Like you say, they don't care about this kind of stuff. So if we're trying to make this real for like everyday consumers, what does it mean, sovereignty? Like, what's the benefits they're going to reap from having sovereignty over their, say, digital money or their data?
I think a good way to present that is from a different perspective, right? As in, what DeFi, Web3, crypto actually really provides is a choice, right? A choice when there wasn't a choice before. Like 20 years ago, if I had some, you know, asset, money, value, the only place I had to put it was the traditional financial market, in a bank, or I could invest it in stock markets, or you know, brokerages and stuff like that. There was no choice. I had to use that financial system whether I liked it or not, right? Where the advent of Bitcoin and blockchain, Web3, DeFi, people now have a choice. They can choose. Well, actually, I don't like the banks, so I'm going to choose to be in charge of my own money. I'm going to choose self-sovereignty because that fits better with my ideals, right? If people still want to use banks and the traditional financial system, that's fine. Like they, you know, they do provide services that DeFi doesn't do very well right now, like mortgages. For example, right? Mortgages are necessary. Yeah. Like, there's only, you know, if you can afford to buy a house without a mortgage, you're very lucky. But most people need a mortgage. So you can't get a mortgage in DeFi. So you have to go to a bank or, you know, some other lending institution. But you can have a choice. You can say, well, I'm going to have my savings account in stable USDC on Web3 and in DeFi, but I'm going to have my mortgage and my credit card with these financial institutions. I can choose now, right? And never had that before. It was, you just got to use this, or it's tough. And I think that's the bigger thing. Yeah, and I think that it's simpler to explain that to people than it is what self-sovereignty is. You start with that, and then you can get into all those kind of more idealistic like opportunities, right?
Yeah, I think you're so right. I actually love that you've hit on that element of choice. I think that's something that we talk about a lot. I always bang this drum of, you know, crypto, Web3 does not need to keep trying to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I always use that phrase, right? It's not about completely throwing out all the old systems. It's about giving people an alternative, an option, a credible, viable alternative.
What is better for that person, right?
Exactly.
If the current financial system, the traditional financial system, is better for you, then fine, right? But if what crypto and Web3 and DeFi offers is better for you, then you can use that too.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we were saying about it being a big thing and, you know, in the past, a lot of the people who've probably been in DeFi for a long time have been there for some of those elements, for some of those value propositions. But there is a lot of value to be had from DeFi, as you said, that doesn't just come from the sovereignty aspect. It comes from what you can do with it. But even that, I think, is still quite limited to a subset of people who know and feel comfortable about what DeFi is, how to use it, you know, what on earth's going on. So How do we broaden the scope of DeFi to include more people who maybe don't even know right now that it has value for themselves? How do we overcome, and what are those kind of big obstacles for the everyday person who isn't using DeFi but could benefit from it?
Yeah, I think there's probably two things. So like, the user experience is still way too nerdy, right? It's too technical, it's too complicated. And because of that, there's no familiarity when, you know, a normie, for want of a better term, and I use that term lovingly, you know, they venture into DeFi, you know, they get MetaMask or whatever, and it's just, what do I do with this, right? And what's this thing I need called a ledger or a YubiKey or all these other things, and what's a hash and what's a signature and all this stuff? Doesn't make any sense to them, right? Nothing is familiar at all. And so you've already got a huge barrier to friction there, because people don't like that, or, you know, the anxiety of, I'm doing something new, and if I do it wrong, it's going to cost me real money, right? So the user experience has got to be 10 times better than it is right now. It's got to feel familiar. It's got to feel like the apps that they are used to using, right? Like your wallet needs to feel like, dare I say it, a banking app, right? And if it feels like a banking app and a lot of the process of getting onboarded into that is streamlined, and I don't think it all needs to feel familiar. I think just the initial hit has to feel somewhat familiar, right? Okay, I know what this button would do if I pressed it, and I know what this is, and I know what this is, and the layout looks, you know, somewhat familiar. So there's definitely that user experience aspect, both in terms of the user interfaces, but also when you're interacting with the dApps and stuff as well, right? And then there's also the application stack, I guess, for want of a better word, right? Like, what are the applications running on? And, you know, at the moment, it's predominantly EVM, right? The Ethereum Virtual Machine, which, you know, it's good for some things, but it's not that great to build complex financial applications in, because it's a steep learning curve for a developer, you know, somebody who's building a dApp. And most of the time they spend 80% of the time making sure they've written the code correctly and only 20% of the time actually writing code that's useful, right? And because of the complexity of these application, you know, and execution environments, it's very easy to make a mistake. You know, you've heard about re-entrancy, re-tax, and all these. If you're not a techie, don't worry about these terms. It just means that the application that you're using, somebody can take advantage of it, and maybe, you know, steal funds or make the application not work in the way it was intended and stuff like that. And then you, as the user on the end of it, you know, you log in one day and suddenly the application doesn't work, or some funds that were there were lost, or, you know, all kinds of nasty things can happen. And part of that is also, you know, it's part user experience, but it's also part, let's say, developer experience as well, right? Developers and the development environment is not sufficient to suddenly onboard, you know, potentially hundreds of millions of people, you know, people who aren't that technical. They have busy lives, so they don't have a lot of time to learn about it, and they just want something that works, right? I can take advantage of this nice APR opportunity and click a button and I can just leave it, and I come back in 3 months' time and I've made some money.
But Dan, on that point, so is there a fear? You know, I completely acknowledge, I think everyone's been banging this drum for a while about user experience, mnemonics, blah, blah, blah. People don't want to touch this stuff. And then what we've seen is a lot of the solutions for that tends to be a centralization of things, like be it like a custodian that maybe handles the mnemonics, handles your keys, and then you lose some of the many benefits we've already talked about, like the sovereignty, the peer-to-peer nature. Is that a fear in your mind that the industry's kind of trying to appease people for what they expect right now, and then moving into this weird like Web 2.5 world where you lose some of the kind of fundamental benefits of, say, crypto and DeFi and all this stuff?
I think it's laziness, right? Because they are traditional solutions to the problem, right? From traditional finance. So they are tried and tested for that industry, yeah? And they work in this industry too. But that doesn't mean that they are the right solution, right? Or because, as you say, you know, decentralization and stuff, centralized services to combat some of these problems. The reason they exist is, one, everybody knows how to set them up because it's tried and tested. Number two, it does actually do the job that you want, just not in the way that we would like it to be. And number three, capital outlay, you can make profit on it quickly. And there's no real hard challenges to solve that, right? So it's the path of least resistance to solving a problem that then can make profits, right?
Yeah.
And so it's the lazy approach, in my opinion. It's the chase profit approach. There are people in the space that are obviously spending a lot of time and effort on, you know, investigating and building proper solutions for these things that align more with the, you know, the ideal of Web3. But I think it was kind of inevitable for a period of time that these problems that don't have a solution, somebody would step in and implement traditional finance solutions, which bridge the gap because they're tried, tested, they're easy to set up, and they make money.
Yeah, well, on that point, I think I'm glad you've raised that, because when we're talking about global adoption of DeFi and onboarding, you know, the next 100 million, maybe billion users, I think, you know, you've covered the usability problems. They're very clear. The developer experience, the, you know, the tooling being a little bit difficult to pass, things changing, and then also the risk associated with it, right? The security, the breaches, there's lots to monitor and protect against when you're building these apps themselves and protocols themselves. But what about, you touched on the kind of almost the corporate and business side there. How important do you think is it to get the buy-in of businesses, fintech companies. You know, we've seen a lot of interest in the last year or so, I think, from some of the investment banks, fintech companies, in trying to kind of dip their toes in this water. Do you think that's important to achieving the goal, that kind of top-down approach of getting 100 million, billion users on? Or do you think we should be focusing more on the kind of bottom-up?
I think institutions definitely play a part, right? I was at some meeting like a decade ago and drew on the whiteboard, you know, exactly this thing, right? You're going to have your kind of public permissionless network in the middle where you have value and you have users, and then you're going to have various institutions and various industries, right? You know, not just financial, that have a kind of toe into that permissionless network because there is value there, right? They can sell services there. They can generate revenue there. They can provide services that are valuable to people within that permissionless environment. So I think it was always inevitable. I think it's taken a bit longer to come around than I initially expected. You know, I thought we'd be looking at, you know, at least large institutions such as banks and like hedge funds and things and private offices and stuff interacting in a deeper way maybe 5 years ago. But I think that they definitely will be an important part of the ecosystem because it just bridges that gap in a good way. Right? There are bad ways to do it, but I believe this is a good way where they can offer, you know, Web3 like services, but those services can still be provided in a way that maintains decentralization, you know, and things like self-sovereignty and the stuff we've been talking about, because those services actually live in the permissionless network. They're just like, you know, the orchestrators or the deployers of services and stuff. And I think the institutions, financial institutions, will play definitely, you know, like, they are important as an on-ramp into the crypto ecosystem as well. You know, like a bank offering their customers to be able to buy Bitcoin, for example, right? The bank has got the custody, perhaps. Yeah, maybe that custody, maybe those Bitcoin live in the Bitcoin network and the bank has the keys. Or, you know, it's not an ETF or some derivative or something. It's maybe, you know, actual Bitcoin. And I, as a consumer, I own Bitcoin, right? But that then potentially opens a can of worms and a Alice in Wonderland rabbit hole. Okay, so I've got this Bitcoin at the bank, but can I hold the Bitcoin myself? Like, can I get it out of the bank? Like, what else is there I can do here? You know, people get curious, right? Like, these are new products, and everybody's heard about, you know, crypto and all of the horror stories that the media like to push out. But, you know, if my bank has held my Bitcoin for a year and nothing bad has happened, then maybe I want to go and take a little deeper peek underneath the hood, right, and see what else is going on. So I think they'll be very important as a kind of adoption funnel as well. And it will get people familiar with the idea of owning Bitcoin, even if it's at the bank, right? I own some Bitcoin, just in the way where I might own some gold, but I don't have the physical gold. It's at a brokerage or something, right? I think there'll be a good catalyst. And obviously the institutions are interested because the types of financial instruments that they can build are, you know, the opportunity is much bigger than they can and have been doing, you know, for the past centuries, right? It's an opportunity for them too. You know, they can completely different types of exotic instruments that are more secure too, right? Like, you know, potentially the thing that caused the housing, you know, mortgage crisis in 2008 couldn't happen if that was all on chain, because you couldn't bundle all of those subprime mortgages because the contract wouldn't allow you to.
One would like to hope anyway.
Well, you would hope, yeah. As long as the developer experience is good, then yeah, that couldn't happen.
So you've been talking about good solutions, developer experience, onboarding, all this kind of stuff. I think it's about time we talked about the work that you're doing at Radix. Could you give us a little bit of a, you know, 101 on what you're doing there?
Yeah, sure. So we've touched on two of the pillars of our focus, right? So user experience and developer experience. So Radix is a full stack implementation of a L1 protocol that focuses on user experience, developer experience, but also scalability too. I've been around in this space since essentially the beginning, right? It's like 12, 13 years now, if not longer. And one of the first things that, you know, I was curious about Bitcoin from the point of view of it's solved this long-standing computer science problem. We'll get into the technicals about that, you know. Yeah. And then it was, okay, the economic potential of this is also very big. And then, you know, think forward 20 years, how is this thing gonna support 8 billion people, right? And so that's kind of where my labor of love for Radix started, because took Bitcoin apart, and even though Satoshi had a scaling plan for it that would have scaled to a degree, the downside was it was trading decentralization and security for that scale. And what got me very much orange-pilled, as the term is now, is that of, you know, decentralization, permissionlessness, you know, all of those things. And then the you know, the Model T Ford of all of this is trading off those important ideals for scale. So that kind of didn't gel with me very well. I was already sold on the whole permissionless decentralization thing. So I started a very long journey of how would you build a protocol that can scale to, you know, 8 billion people and fridges and IoT toasters, mm-hmm. and AI, yes. and all these things, right? And it turns out that's not a hard problem. It's an odd problem. So over a decade and many iterations and millions of dollars spent doing R&D on scale. And then we had the solution for the scale. And along the way, you know, we'd also identified that user experience is crap and developer experience is awful. So we also included like them into the mandate of things. And Babylon, which is the network which is live at the moment, has a lot of the user experience stuff, you know, a much better developer stack. Everybody that uses the wallet or build something on Radix, it's like, I don't ever want to look at MetaMask or EVM ever again, right? And we kind of did it backwards. So we had the solution for the scale first, but then the scale is like a rolling roadmap, because scale is useless if there's nobody on the highway, right? So yeah, we figured UX and DevX are better to start with.
Today's episode is sponsored by the VeChain Foundation.
Now, we often talk about how emerging technologies like blockchain have the potential to revolutionize sustainability. And VeChain is at the forefront of this green movement with initiatives like VBetterDAO. Let's take a closer look.
Imagine tracking small actions like recycling at low cost, making them valuable assets. These verified records build a massive collective impact, benefiting people through their own actions. Sound a bit complex, but VeChain made it fun. Explore our apps at VBetter.com.
VeChain's goal is to power a new era of sustainable solutions. So if you've got an app idea or just want to earn rewards for small, sustainable actions every day, go check out vbetterdao.com to find out more. And now, back to the show.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. I'd love to double-click on the scalability point for a moment here and then maybe get into the kind of the other side of things at Radix. But, you know, I noticed if you talk about who are the household names in crypto and blockchain, right? And I'm talking normal household, like the normie households, right, that you mentioned. So your average kind of person on the street who is not deep into the weeds like we are, you're talking maybe Bitcoin and then, you know, Ethereum at a stretch, okay? Yeah. Now, Bitcoin, everyone knows, very slow, low TPS on chain, you know, like 7 TPS or something like that, transactions per second. You go to Ethereum, it's still, you know, pretty low, maybe an order of magnitude higher. They're aiming for 100,000, I think they keep saying, but this is always kind of a moving goal. And then Radix really caught my eye because you're, I guess you're one of the blockchains that are really built around scale, as you said, right? Just so focused on solving this problem. And I saw something like 2.2 million TPS last year. Is that right? It's something that, you know, that's a mind-blowing number compared to what's on the market. So yeah, can you lift a little bit on how on earth have you achieved that, and what are these kind of R&D gold nuggets that got you there?
Sure. So I suppose the gold nugget on how we got there was the approach taken, right? So you look at the scaling solutions that are available or on roadmaps, and they very much build on existing, right? So, you know, they take a Bitcoin style Nakamoto blockchain, and then they think, well, you know, if we tweak this or we do this, then we'll get, you know, 100 TPS or 200 TPS or whatever, right? And so they're just tweaking the existing protocol. The way that I always kind of put it is, we're back in the 1850s, I've got a horse and I want to make the horse faster. So I concentrate on, you know, looking after the horse better, making better horse feed, making the cart that it's pulling a bit lighter. So, you know, it's a bit more efficient in that way. Instead of actually just thinking, why don't I just build a truck, right? I build a truck, it can carry more than the horse. You know, it's like, what, that's kind of the analogy that I think about it. Everyone's trying to make better horse feed. Some people are going really too far and trying to put, you know, a jet engine in a horse. That's not going to end well for the horse. Instead of just going, you know, okay, let's just think about the fundamentals of what we need and, you know, things around the scale, the decentralization, the security and stuff. And all the principles that Bitcoin brought to us, how do we start from a clean slate, incorporate all of those things, but also achieve scale while maintaining decentralization and security, right? Start from scratch, right? What do you need to build? And that was the approach that I took when I really kind of started on Radix back in 2013. And it's been incremental, right? So, you know, build something, okay, that's progress, but it's not enough. Lesson learned, throw that away, go back to the drawing board, start again, open new file, build a new protocol. That gets closer, still not quite there. You know, because like in my head, I'm thinking, I've got to have 8 billion people, God knows how many IoT devices, AI's coming. I mean, this was 10 years ago, AI's coming, right? You're going to have, you know, global e-commerce, trading, maybe even social networks, file systems, all these things integrated, right? You don't need Visa scale. This was a common thing back in like 2013. Everyone was thinking about Visa scale. Yeah, if we get to Visa scale, we're good. And it's like, Visa scale is nowhere near good enough. That's just credit card, right? That's just like,
yeah. That's what, like 60,000 or something like that, right? It's nothing near what we need.
Average it was, I think Visa average is like 2,000 to 3,000 a second, right? Globally, yeah. And that's what everybody was shooting for. And I'm over here, you know, crazy guy in the corner thinking, well, it's going to be millions, you know, it's like, and that was kind of the approach. So a completely different approach. You know, forget the horse, just build a truck or, you know.
And so then, Dan, yeah. I guess the question is how? Like, so, you know, maybe the dinner tables that we're at knows about the famous trilemma problem: security, decentralization, scalability. Obviously, you've solved the scalability problem. How have you maintained like high security and decentralization with that kind of scale? Like, is there, okay, it might be hard to explain it in like
what's,
you
know, in the
TLDR.
I can explain it in ELI 5, right? Because I'm sure you don't want the ELI 60. Yeah. So you mentioned something interesting, like the trilemma, right? So and a common misconception, it wasn't Vitalik that coined that term either, although it's attributed to him. It was Vlad Zamfir. He was the first one to make a diagram saying there's a trilemma here, right? So generally in the trilemma now, it's like, okay, you've got throughput, you've got decentralization, and you've got security, right? And people say, some people say that's unsolvable, and some people say they've solved it, right? Now it's unsolvable. You can't solve the trilemma, right? And everybody stops there, right? They don't think beyond that, right? So if trilemma can't be solved, it's like, yeah, but just think about it from a different point of view. Let's say you theoretically, you have a network that can do 1 billion transactions per second. It has 1 billion nodes, and it's secured by $1 trillion of economic security, right? Is that sufficient across all those things? And if it is sufficient across all those things, then who gives a shit about the trilemma, right? Because you haven't solved the trilemma, but you've been able to push the bounds of the trilemma to such a point where it doesn't matter anymore, right? 1 billion transactions a second is enough for anything. You've got 1 billion nodes, which is enough decentralization for anything. And you've got $1 trillion worth of economic security securing the network. That's enough for anything, right? And so if you take that mindset, it's like, okay, how do I build a system that can preserve all of those fundamentals that Satoshi brought along and all the cypherpunks before them? That, you know, Satoshi wasn't the first to have this idea. Obviously, it's been an idea for decades. So Satoshi was the first to do it in a permissionless way. But then you want to preserve all those fundamentals in a way and build a protocol that pushes the bounds of the trilemma so far out that it just doesn't matter anymore, right? It's nonsense to argue against them. And what do you need to do that? And that takes 10 years.
So just some like high levels, is it UTXO based? You said that it's like taking a lot of inspiration. Like, what kind of consensus mechanism are you working with? You said there's a lot of inspiration from Bitcoin and like from EVM style.
There's obviously you're always building on the shoulders of giants to some degree, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're taking some theory from here or a piece of this from over there. But there's so many different ways of putting these things together, and you need a bit of glue in the middle, right? So, you know, things like the consensus mechanism, there's a lot of stuff that is fundamental, but the consensus mechanism itself is novel, right? It's from the ground up, because there wasn't a consensus mechanism available that provided everything that I needed, right? So it's like, okay, I've got to build a new consensus mechanism that does, but a lot of that consensus mechanism is borrowing from like PBFT and Nakamoto consensus and all these bits and pieces, right? Just in the way that Satoshi developing Bitcoin borrowed from lots of different places, right? Okay, we've got a directed acyclic graph. I mean, it's a chain, but it's still a directed acyclic graph, right? We've got a directed acyclic graph of UTXOs and how all of those things have a relationship with each other. I'm going to use Adam Back's hash cash as a means of proof of work, and I can kill two birds with one stone with that, right? Like, that's all everybody's really doing, yeah? Like, 90% of innovation is stuff that exists. It's the 10% that is the magic, right? So, you know, consensus mechanism is new. The sharding mechanism as well, completely different to anything out there. You know, it's just that whole take a step back approach and look at the forest and not the trees. Yeah, what do I need, right? How do I build what I need? And there was never any, I think I had an advantage of, there was never a rush to market, right? I could take my time with it. The community were very supportive of it. You know, 10 years is a long time, right? Like, a lot of these guys have had a lot of patience, but it's only really recently where it's, you know, the urgency is maybe a little bit more, because we have the tech, right? So now I want to show it off, and the timing is right and everything as well. The timing is perfect for this kind of solution. So.
Yeah, so I think that's probably about as good an LE5 overview as you can give, right?
I mean, any more than that, and I'm going to start talking about quorum signatures and BLS and aggregation and all these things. It's just, you know, it's a completely different approach and very bespoke.
It is very difficult.
When you see the full picture, it's like, oh, yeah, of course, right?
Yeah.
Of course you would do it that way. But that's the hardest thing, right? Is having the inspiration to think about doing it that way, and then everybody else is like, "Oh, I could have thought of that. Why didn't you?"
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. You can definitely see the inspirations or the influences from Bitcoin and Satoshi, as you've mentioned, right? And I think, I'm glad you pointed out how much of a hodgepodge Bitcoin really was. People kind of forget just how much it drew on other things, right? Things that have been invented before, and it just kind of took the pieces and put them together in a new way to make something new happen, right? Yeah. And I think that's something that it gets overlooked a lot. And it sounds to me like, even from that high level description, you're taking one of the big benefits of Bitcoin, which a lot of people don't appreciate actually, is that the parallelism of Bitcoin, right? The fact that the UTXO model gives you parallel validation of transactions. I think, you know, I had a quick look at Radix in more detail before we started this, and it seems like that parallelism is something you guys are leveraging, but trying to marry it with a lot of the other things you kind of get inspiration from Ethereum and the EVM for, you know, digital assets, right? And I also, you know, I noticed digital assets are a first class citizen in Radix, which is really interesting. So instead of going all the way down the rabbit hole, I just wanted to highlight those points. But Dana, what I really wanted to ask you is, how on earth did 10 years ago you take that pivot? Because I noticed you're a game developer by trade previously.
I was many years ago. Yeah.
So how what was the path like going from that world and then kind of completely hard pivoting into something that is, in my mind, totally different? Maybe it's not.
Yeah, it wasn't really a hard pivot, because you're missing some in the middle, right? So okay. I was a game developer from like the mid 90s till early 2000s. And then I just kind of got bored of it, I think, right? It's very high pressure. You know, the salary was good, but it was, you know, I'm going to work in a fairly beaten up old banger, and the, you know, the CEO just turn up in a Ferrari, but yet I'm the one who's there 18 hours a day eating pizza and drinking Coke all day, right? So it was like, you know, I've got some good ideas. Maybe I'll go and start something myself. And it was about this time when Nokia's came with the Snake game. Yeah, it's like, games on mobile. Okay. So kind of saved up some money with some friends and left that and did some mobile games and stuff. And then from there, went into, it was a friend of mine was working on contactless, well, near field communication stuff, right? He had some ideas. So he was like, why don't you come over to Germany and work on this? You know, I've got some ideas about ticketing and payments. Yeah. Can we use it as a payment system? Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I'm tired of games anyway. You know, I left that, wanted to do something else. So I was there for a number of years and we kind of built this whole system for, you know, managing NFC payments on phones. I've got a couple of old Nokias with just like circuit boards hanging out with this NFC board on, and you like
not suspect at all.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I'll never throw that thing away because it was just, you know, it's kind of a piece of history, I suppose, to a degree. And then, you know, kind of exited that and then went into kind of OEM and a telecom operator, you know, building bespoke solutions for them guys and stuff. That was successful. Worked with some big names there. Left that and was kind of taking a 6 month, what do I want to do next? And then, yeah, Bitcoin. It's like, ooh, maybe my calling.
From NFC to NFT.
Oh, no.
Nice.
Sorry.
I like that. That's a good tagline.
You can have that.
Dan, we've talked a little bit about, you know, what you're doing now, what you were doing previously. I kind of want to talk about the future a little bit. You said that about all these many, many transactions that are going to come about, not just from humans, but also from IoT devices, also from AI. Like, what do you think the future is for DeFi, for, you know, for yourself, for Radix in the next 5 to 10 years? Like, is it Nokia's on chain? Like, what do you think this needs to do basically to solve all the world's problems?
I think it needs to get out of this speculatory driven environment, right? Like, speculation is, you know, trading and those kind of things. Like, it's important to an economy that you have those elements, right? But crypto these days is very much weighed towards speculation. Like, I would say 95%, if not more, of all the activity in the crypto ecosystem as a whole is just speculation, right?
All these meme coins as well, recently.
Coins and, oh, you know, yeah. NFTs and all this stuff, right? And that's fine if it's balanced by, you know, actual use, utility, real world use cases and stuff like that. Yeah. And it's just not balanced at all. And I think that if that doesn't change, then this industry is going to be in a real difficult place in like 5 years or so, right? Because at that point, you're getting to the point where it's very difficult to change the perception of what the industry is at that point, right? It will just be perceived as, you know, speculation. And the longer that continues as well, the more integrated it will become with TradFi, right? Because this all this over here is just a speculation tool, right? So let's just keep pulling it closer and closer and closer. Like the things like the ETF, right? Okay, for short term and medium term, but long term, it's like, no, why is everybody happy about this, right? For, over the long term, we're just being integrated more deeper and closer to traditional financial system. And the problem with that, of course, is eventually the choice that we were speaking about earlier is just eroded because TradFi, traditional finance, will become the gatekeepers of these networks, right? Mm-hmm. And it'll be very hard to fight back at that point. So I think it needs to balance out, right? It needs to balance out with real use cases. And there's a lot happening, but I think people have just got to be mindful that some of them are slow burns, right? Like RWA, real world assets on chain, right? That's going to be a slow burn, but juggernaut in 5-10 years, yeah? And the reason that's slow, of course, is because in a lot of instances, there are physical assets, right? There's logistics involved with that. There's various registries or, you know, what's it called? Oh, yeah. Is it Providence? Provenance. I'm thinking of that band. Provenance and stuff, right? Like, all this stuff and like supply chain as well, right? It's not just, oh yeah, we're going to build, we're going to put supply chain on the blockchain. Okay, great. You have a shipping company that's on the blockchain. What about all the ports? What about all the people who are transporting the containers, right? Are they using that system? Or because if they're not, then what's the point? So there's a lot of real world utility that's possible, but I think it's all fairly slow because it's not digital. Digital stuff can happen fast. Non-digital stuff where there's real physical things involved, that's slow. And the other thing we've got to do is we've got to, you know, once we have the user experience that's better for regular consumers and, you know, products and services for them that aren't just trading on dog with hats, right? Then there's a lot of education that needs to happen there as well. And there's probably a lot of sentiment change that needs to happen because you ask most people in the street about crypto, but oh yes, scammers and drug dealers. Like, you know, that perception has been manufactured, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's been one of those almost existential risks hanging over the space for as long as it's existed, and it kind of goes up and down. But
it's got to change. Like the next 5 years, I think, is kind of do or die, right? Either we will reap the benefits or they will be gone forever.
Yeah, I agree. It feels like that kind of window is kind of closing slowly. But yeah, in the next 5 to 10, if we haven't finally proven the true value of this, then at some point, you know, the music's going to stop on the industry. So yeah, I completely concur with that. Just to finish off, Dan, you mentioned obviously the use cases with great utility, which I think obviously we need to promote and get kind of more awareness about. Is there one kind of singular use case that gets you out of bed, that gets you most excited, that you want to see built on Radix in the future? Like, is there one that you have in mind, or are you just happy to kind of, you know, come one, come all?
I suppose I have, yeah, I have like one I always think would be great. It probably wouldn't because, you know,
Nokia on chain, isn't it? The Nokia brick on chain.
Yeah, sorry. No, it's like things like creator content, right? Like a proper Web3 YouTube, right? Where, you know, I'm creating content and then I can, you know, certain bits of that content I can sell as an NFT and then, you know, auction them off, and then there can be secondary markets for them and stuff, right? Like, and maybe, like, you know, Web3 social and stuff as well, like that can supplement that creator economy. I think if that can be done well and there is the scale to support it, right? Like the problem with that is it needs to be an economy of scale, right? Like it needs to be a big thing like YouTube is, otherwise you're not going to pull the creators because you don't have the viewers, right? So there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem. But I think if somebody can navigate that, because there's no way YouTube's ever going to go Web3, right? Like they're happy where they are. But this whole Web3 DeFi, you know, in charge of my own data, et cetera, that all just lands very well for creators. Yeah, you know, like YouTube, you know, video creators, musicians, artists, all these things lands very well in their kind of wheelhouse. And so I think if there was any, that really gets me thinking, right, in terms of wouldn't that be cool if you could have all these independent creators properly profiting from the content they create. Mm. Instead of getting pennies on the dollar and stuff. You know, is it feasible? Can it be done? You know, you're going up against YouTube and others. Same with social networks. Like, you know, Web3 social networks are a great idea in principle, but in practice, you know, they've been tried a few times and they haven't really got anywhere. And I don't think the failure has been because of lack of scale, right? Because there's been some, you know, really innovative ideas around how to get around some of those current limitations, and they just haven't really taken off. But you know, those kind of things are interesting, I think. And then obviously you've got DeFi, I'm interested in that, and RWA and all these other things that are coming. But those are the two where I always kind of get a bit of a that'd be good.
Well, nice, because that links back to, it's like the full character arc, right? You started in the gaming industry, lots of creator content and all this kind of stuff. Like, it makes sense that should be your focus. And I think that's probably one of like the earliest use cases we saw out of just pure finance was all the NFT Bored Ape stuff, like it or hate it. Like, it does make sense. Yeah, like
I really thought for a while that, okay, this NFT phase with all these talented artists making all this, you know, content, is that going to be the catalyst that kind of, you know, pushes a creator economy into becoming a thing? And then it kind of went, no.
It was too
late. We're going to take these Bored Apes, we're just going to speculate the shit out of them. Oh, come on, guys, please.
It was just too volatile. But all this RWA stuff, that's just another term for like NFTs and tokenization, right? RWA is just the same term.
Yeah, like tokenization, NFT, but the difference is it's physical stuff for the
moment. Yeah, exactly. And the institutions are coming in to tokenize bonds or stocks or anything like that. And on the do or die point you made, I think I am kind of excited. I think I know there's a lot of like naysay about the institutes coming in, but I do think it's going to help the industry because they're going to really look into a project before they invest in it and see that it is solving a problem, see that it has got fundamentals, characteristics that make it desirable. It's not just going to be a dog with a hat on, like you said, it's going to get investment from the BlackRocks of the world. So I think it is a good thing. I think they are going to look at, you know, solutions that are solving problems and not just looking for problems. So I am hopeful and excited, and hopefully Redex will be part of that as well.
I have conversations with quite a few institutions, you know, been on various panels and things, and at least right now, you know, the individuals that are responsible for those initiatives in those said financial institutions, they are very much of the same ilk as us to a large degree, right? You know, they are passionate, they are technical, they're engineers, so they are, at least, you know, now the people that are looking at building solutions on this technology are coming at it from, you know, a similar angle, you know, with a similar mindset that we are, you know, engineering mindset, you know, this is good, there's opportunity here, there's a lot of interesting, useful things we can build, right? The key, of course, is for it to stay that way when the big wigs at the institutions have a lot more say on what is and isn't built and how those initiatives and strategies they're running are implemented. But I think for now, having the institutions on board with that caliber of people is you know, it may bring with it not just users but also a lot of innovation as well.
Yeah, I think a fairly optimistic note to end on. So thank you for that, Dan. And yeah, it's been a huge pleasure to talk to you, Dan. Thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
Yeah, and I'm excited to see what happens in the future for Redix. We'll definitely keep an eye out, and hopefully we'll talk to you again in the future. But thanks for joining us, Dan. And to everyone listening at home, thank you for listening. You can join us next time to untangle a little more Web3.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.